Score, the podcast. The only show taking you inside the studios of the world's most celebrated composers and musical storytellers. Presented by Spitfire Audio.
I'm Kenny Holmes.
Well, that's interesting. I think you're expecting me to say I'm Robert Kraft, and I will. I wasn't entirely prepared, but I am now ready to say we are Score, the podcast, and we are so excited to have this episode's going to blaze.
I know. I feel like we're setting the bar now that like every episode's going to have two guests. We can't guarantee that, but it's a lot of fun, and there's a lot going on in these double episode guests. Yep. Say good morning to composer Carol.
Good morning.
Is your camera working out all right, Carol? I know you were having some camera issues.
It should be, right?
Yeah, it looks good now.
It should be, but
your plants look nice. Everything, you got your records on the wall there.
They make me happy.
You put your records on. Carol, here's my self quiz. Is that an E?
Nope. F sharp.
Okay. Let's keep moving because
why
I have
are we doing this?
I have to work hard on my pitch.
Do you do this every day?
Every day I ask Carol if I'm in tune. And every day I'm slightly out of tune. So that's all we have for you. Good episode.
All right. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you in a couple weeks. Thanks for tuning in.
Thank you.
No, we have a jam-packed show. We have two guests kicking things off with another rock star, Isabella Summers, a.k.a. The Machine of Florence and the Machine, who has recently gone into the scoring world and is just, as Robert would say, having a moment.
Yeah, crushing it. I think there's four shows on right now as a composer, and can't wait to talk to her.
Yeah, so it's going to be a lot of fun. She's joining us from London, and then followed up by Oscar-winning composer Elliot Goldenthal, who has just
a legend,
a laundry list of huge movies, and he is a legend in the business. And we've been wanting to get him on, and he's an East Coast guy, so everybody, we're doing math here with our time zones, and we're making this all work out, and we're very excited to bring those guests to you. Before we get to them, though, we want to take a moment, as always, to thank our sponsor, Spitfire Audio, maker of orchestral sample libraries for film composers. Whether you're just starting out or a seasoned professional, Spitfire has so many sounds you will love.
Yeah, every month, a cool thing, and I'd like to say, yeah, which is a very formal way to start this. They release a new library in their free lab series, and you can get an entire orchestra for free in the form of their BBC Symphony Orchestra Discover Edition. I got it.
And it doesn't include that siren I just heard, whatever that
was. Well, that siren is, they're coming for me, so we got to go quick.
At the end of this episode, you're going to hear a demo from another one of their terrific packages. This cue will be from the Spitfire Symphonic Strings Professional Package, the ultimate symphonic strings for the definitive blockbuster sound captured at Air Studios London, which we featured in the documentary and have talked about many times on this show, and featuring an incredible array of articulations and mics. They really know what they're doing at Air with the mics.
Man, and how about Spitfire with a Symphonic Strings Professional Package? I mean, what an asset for a composer. And the best part of it, Score, the podcast listeners, save 25% off their first purchase of any Spitfire Audio product.
Huge.
The promo code SCORE2021.
You better be using that code. We talk about it. These episodes live on, but the code doesn't last forever. So get on there. If you're a first-time user of Spitfire, this is your chance to save 25%. Score 2021. And then again, at the end of the show today, we're going to play you a cue from the Spitfire Symphonic Strings Professional Package, which you can save 25% on if you like what you're hearing. All right, let's get to it. Before we get to our first guest, the Emmy nominations are out. Hollywood is abuzz. We're not going to do it on this show because we have two guests and a lot to get to, but head over to More Score because we're breaking down the nominees. We're making predictions. Robert, you have a bold prediction here. I don't know how it's going to play out, but I'm interested to see what happens after the Thank Emmys you. Actually get handed out. And Matt Schrader will be joining us as well over on More Score. If you haven't joined yet, patreon.com/morescore. Exclusive interviews, merchandise, and stuff that you won't get here on Score the Podcast. And then again, we always like to mention that when this season of Score the Podcast ends, More Score does not. So it's a year-round show. So come on for the ride. It's a lot of fun, and we're going to be getting into a bunch of stuff. You recently talked with Alan Meyerson, yeah. Which can you share a little bit with our audience, who, if they haven't checked that out yet, what should we know about Alan Meyerson that they should go check out?
I would say that probably 2/3 of the motion picture scores that you've heard in the last 25 years have been recorded and mixed by Alan Meyerson. I don't think I have to say any more. He's probably the top recording and mixing engineer for motion picture music on the planet, and also a really great guy and a great friend. So I had a ball talking to him.
Yeah, he's worked with everybody. I'm sure everybody. That the stories are just everybody. Endless. Alan Meyerson, and then Peter Rotter.
Yeah, Peter's also great. And these are, this really fills in the kind of portfolio of what any film music fan, film music professional needs to know. Alan Meyerson, you need to know who that is. Peter Rotter, he will book your sessions. He will get the musicians for you. He will make sure you're on budget and on time. And I had a great talk with Peter just about his history and about what it's like during the pandemic and now post-pandemic to put orchestra dates together.
So yeah, check that out. Patreon.com/morescore. There's video as well, so you can watch it at home or you can listen to it in the car or however you get us. Same thing with Score the Podcast now. Hope you're checking us out on YouTube. All the shows are up on video as well. And we have all those links on our social media pages that you can go check out. So I think let's get to it. Let's just make it official. Joining us now, she's an Emmy and Grammy nominated recording artist, songwriter, composer. She's displaying herself like she's on The Price is Right right now. And you know her music from hit shows like Little Fires Everywhere, Panic, Riviera, and Physical. And of course, she's the Machine from Florence and the Machine. We're so excited to have Isabella Summers joining the show today. Isabella, how are you?
That was quite an introduction. Thank you, Kenny. I've literally waited my whole life for somebody to reel all the things off that I've done that are successful. Thank you. That made me feel better about today. Today's been awesome. I'm really good, thank you. God, I did all those things, guys. Yes.
I mean.
Oh, Robert, we can't hear you, can we?
Robert, you're muted.
Hello.
You're so much excited.
Better, much better.
He's pushing buttons.
Can you hear me now?
We can.
Yes.
Isabella, I was asking, where are you right now? Are you in London?
I'm in London for my sins.
How lovely.
Do you know what? It is. It really is. It's pouring with rain. And
really?
And it's like, I mean, the heavens are hysterical, I like to say. And like, they are just literally pouring down and the wind is blowing. And it's just like, it's really nice. Pretty nice to be
now
inside.
are you always this energetic, or is it because it's the afternoon, because it's morning for us?
Do you know what, I've kind of been in a bit of a funk today. Well, no, I had a really great meeting at lunchtime, then I had the afternoon lull, and now you guys are picking me up back up again.
We're going to pick your spirits up. We have been known, people actually carry us other places to just make sure that we
It's a bit ridiculous.
And I can tell you, I don't know if this is good or bad news, we are suffering through, it's dropped down from 72 to 71 in Los Angeles today, Fahrenheit.
That sounds like a lot of warm weather.
We saw one cloud about an hour ago. So things here are a little testy. Do you know when we gave the introduction to Isabella, we left something out, which I read last night, which is kind of, in addition to everything else, there was this sentence that said, she also discovered Jeremy O. Harris. And I thought, well, that's very casual.
You know, that's really funny. I don't know why it says that on my Wikipedia. And I reckon I say that to somebody about once a week. I'm like, why does it say that on my Wikipedia? Can we take that off? But
I
nobody
think you should take full credit for it. We are in Hollywood after all. But he's, for those who don't know, as significant a playwright as exists on the planet right now. He
has
that new picture, Zola, which is getting all that attention. He's
Jeremy,
about to
you're getting
produce
a plug here. Oh, my
yes. And what I'm wondering, actually, is why aren't you scoring Zola and the
you
second
can question.
Season?
That's a
let's talk
great
about
great questions.
Let's get to Jeremy. Let's see if we can get him on this. But
I think, yeah, thank you. No, Jeremy and I, we will work together. We've got some things coming
I
out.
I hope so.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. He's in his own world right now. But that's okay, because so am I. So,
yes.
We'll, you know, it will happen.
You are having what we call a moment. I mean, are you aware
I conjured it.
Your name is everywhere.
That's great. Considering that all the music industry ever said to me was, post on Instagram. And I literally hate Instagram with every bone in my body. So I don't go on it really. And I'm just so blessed to be in this moment where I'm getting to do like more and more amazing work and like, you know, constantly be of a certain standard, and not have to push it through Instagram. So it's very nice to hear that. Thank you, Robert, because it's not because of Instagram is what I'm saying. So yes, yay, high five.
As you know, so many people in the music business, their first response when you mention an artist is, how many followers do they have? You know, and it's, well,
I have a really amazing, okay, well, we're on the Score podcast, right? And I don't know if I'm going to be able to grab this quickly, but, and I'm certainly not going to be able to say his name very well, but the guy who was responsible for the most epic piece of music in 2001, A Space Odyssey, Gyorgy Litoji. How do you say it?
Yes, exactly.
Is that how you say it?
We're gonna go with that.
Gyorgy Ligeti.
Yes, Ligeti.
I've got a great little quote about all of this. Oh, come on. He basically. Oh my God, I found
Was
it.
He on Instagram? I can't remember.
This is what's so good. He says, on being a composer, it matters a great deal to me that my work should be understood, but my prime concern is to put an idea in writing. My ideal is Cézanne, who just didn't care whether his paintings were exhibited or not. To do it, that's the main thing. Everything else, putting forward grand theories, gathering followers, becoming a guru, leaves me cold. And that's how
In conclusion, he's not on Instagram. Is what he's basically
or alive anymore, I'm going to say.
Or in conclusion, I just read how Picasso and Braque said, without Cézanne, they never would have existed.
Wow.
So and that's
so,
the case.
But Cézanne gets the next plug.
Yes. You're right. We're going to actually be surrounding you today with artists that get a lot of attention. Ligeti, Cézanne, Jeremy O'Harris. And then at the end, we'll say thanks very much, Isabella, for joining us.
No, I've got more. I've got a few other great people we could talk about.
Oh, good.
No, I'm just...
How about you?
You're the guest today, Isa. Come on. We got to focus on your work today.
Okay. Well, yes. I've done lots of it.
Our guest last episode was Mark Isham, and you came up, and we were talking about Little Fires Everywhere and how he came on board with you, and it was the industry vet meets the rookie,
the machine
in film composing,
the rookie,
the machine. But in terms of film composing, this was your first go, right?
It was Little Fires
Everywhere. And so it's so interesting because you're such an established musician and artist and all of these things, but then you come into this new world and you teamed up with Mark Isham. What was that like working with Mark?
A roller coaster. It was really easy and really just lovely. you know, has spent 14 years trying to get here, I suppose. You know, always trying to lean into cinema. I wanted to be a director. I went to art school and studied film, went to Martin's. And so, like, and I would make these weird horror films for 3 years at art school and then make the weird soundtracks to them. So, like, and I didn't really mean to be in a band. That was a sort of accident, a happy accident.
We got to hear, like, how that
is a fantastic reverse of what everyone else says. I was in a band. I wanted to be in a band. I wanted to be a rock star. And I accidentally heard about film. Please tell us.
No, the other way around.
Yes.
For me. And, well, you know, I sort of grew up, you know, with an extremely eclectic family. My father was a book dealer. And had, you know, rock and roll in his veins from, you know, an early Hackney growing up in the 60s and Jimi Hendrix at the Roundhouse. And he was a huge Bob Dylan fan. And of course, Bob Dylan was known for being, is known for being, you know, having an amazingly eclectic music taste. So all of that Ouroboros of everything flooded into the imagination straight away and continued to do so. And then hip hop sort of shaped everything, because I learned about buying records and sampling anything, everything. And then, you know, the famous story is that I was trying to be a hip hop producer, and I had just someone show me Cubase. And so I had this little studio that everything was running off like a double plug. So, well, then at some point I bought a kettle, and if you boiled the kettle, the whole studio would short. And I'd be like, Pro Tools has crashed. We need to start again. And then,
music or tea, you had to pick.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's like, and then I met Florence. I was working with a bunch of kind of anyone who had anything. I would be like, what's that? Come and let me record it. Hurdy-gurdies, guitars, my friend's indie bands. I would like chop up into my MPC, all of that stuff. And then I met Florence and I was like, oh, you're a singer. Let's try and make a song. And that was how that happened. And then, of course, we did that for such a long time. And the whole time I was like, I really need to do what I wanted to do in the first place, which is cinema. And, you know, making, you know, I love movies so much, and particularly gangster films.
Love that.
I grew up on, like, you know, I love things that are kind of like full of adrenaline and masculine energy and, you know, excitement and all of that stuff. So I basically, but I also loved John Barry's soundtracks for James Bond.
Oh, so nice.
So I sort of grew up with this kind of, like, you know, slightly excited, like, love all of the strings and the kind of drama and the darkness. So I basically, it actually wasn't Little Fires Everywhere that was the real beginning. It was Sam Levinson putting a piece of my music in Assassination Nation was the kind of, like, kickstart. And then that's where I met Mary Ramos, who is...
Known her for a long time.
She's amazing. And she, she said, hey, it's not a movie, but it's going to be amazing. Do you want to do a TV show? And do you want to do it with Mark Isham? Because you're so brand new to this idea. We just were coming off tour and I was like, hell yeah, I'd love to. No idea what that means. And it was basically like, pack a bag, you're coming to LA we're going to need you here. Like, you're going to need to be in every meeting. It's not going to work from London. I think I did my first spotting session. Without a visual from my little studio in London. I thought I could do it in headphones. Wow. I didn't know what I was talking about. So
really quick, though, were you telling Mary, did you tell her that you wanted to be a film composer? Did she have any
indication of this? But she also, like, I mean, she heard this piece of music that I'd made for Sam and was just like,
and can I just ask you, that Assassination Nation cue, was it a needle drop of something you'd already recorded? Did you write something bespoke for him, or did they break down a track that you had and take some
I'd just written it in the studio, and I was like, this is great. And I think I might have sent that and a few other ideas to Sam, And he just picked it out and he was like, this is going in my movie. And I was like, great.
Sight.
And then Mary was like, you're coming with me, kid. You can be John Williams. I was like, okay, cool. What's that mean? Where do we sign? And then she just she was just like, your melodies. I was like, thank you, wonderful. And then, of course, she put me with Aisham, who is extraordinarily, he's a veteran at this.
Yes.
So, it was like, go and hang out with him in
Calabasas.
Calabasas, thank you. Go and hang out in Calabasas every day and get amongst it. And I was like, not too shabby. Okay, I like this new idea.
I'm surprised that you didn't, at some juncture, and it's just the karma of it, while you were becoming one of the world's biggest rock stars, that either someone didn't approach you from a film music agency, one of those film music agents of whom we all know, and say, hey, would you ever want to score a film?
Especially with your interest, yeah.
Right, or you didn't think, let me talk to you.
I just don't know. We were so busy in the whole roller coaster of it all that I didn't. There was it sort of towards the end. I was starting to get antsy about breaking into other things towards the end of that whole run, because there was really just no time to stop. It would be like, we're going again. We're going again. We're writing again. We're going again. Writing again. We're going again. Like, and I have seen the world, and I am so grateful for it. I've seen the world before the world became this world, and I'm so glad that we played every festival and but to be able to come out of all of that and like use my imagination and one set of hands to do all the things that I was doing, but like literally that don't require like a huge army of people to get you anywhere or anything, has been like the most amazing thing of all time. And
do you think you will be balancing in this new world? It's 24 hours in a day. Do you see it being 12 in the studio producing records, writing records, being a pop star, and 12, then I guess you take 30 minutes for tea and business.
I was going to say, there's no sleep time there. Wait
and
a
then
second.
11 and a half hours scoring Star Wars 9 and, Bourne Supremacy. And do you see yourself
I think
dividing?
The second half. Yeah.
So then is Florence scared right now? That's what I'm wondering.
Another plug. let's put her in a box over there for a second and go back to she can go in the box over there. And in this moment right now, I feel extremely free to be able to jump onto anyone's whatever it is that they're into, TV or film, and I'm able to kind of like get into their headspace too. So it's just been like one amazing opportunity after the other, and they keep coming. So those 12 hours of scoring Darth Vader dying, like that's what's exciting right now.
You mentioned that you always wanted to do it. Then you had this 14-year detour.
Hacienda.
Now suddenly you're doing it with Mark, and you did Panic.
Panic.
And you have Physical. Riviera, you wrote that, and you have the new Physical out. Is it different than you imagined? And are you learning film scoring and things about it that you thought, wow, I never realized it was this, or that I had to know this? Are there aspects of it that are surprising?
Yeah, the fact that I'm so capable of it. I have to say,
that's beautiful.
I can't believe it. I just am like, getting, you know, I always, I've got this skill somewhere within me where I feel like, you know, people will become my weapons and I sharpen them. And like, I'm just, for me, I don't know how it is. I think it's just from my, like, I was born with this kind of like encouragement thing. My mom's got it as well. And, I've just been given this, the space, the time, the freedom, and like the encouragement to do it. And with each thing, I'm just getting better and better at it myself. So having spent a long time, like investing in, Jeremy, just write a script. Just come with me on tour and just sit there in the corner and write a script. Or like, whoever, write that song. Or you should do this. Or you'd be really good. I'm now able to just kind of like stop for a second and just like through learning, like, and loving it, I'm just getting better and better and better at it. And now, you know, things that like I would before go like, how the hell did they make that? Like, I'm now able to sit and kind of try and figure it out for myself, and then actually go like, "What? That's not a bad take on that."
Do you have different gear for film scoring than you do for making records? I mean, do you have like a big monitor now in your studio? And
yeah, I've got two monitors. I've got you know, the same sort of selection of gear. I've got endless plugins, but I use things in a different way, I suppose. But I was always like, more is more. Like, what's that? Let's have 10 of them. Can you, oh, you've got a violin. Can you record me this? Like, I've written the strings part, but it sounds shit on the keyboard. Can you try, you know, have you got half an hour for me? Like, always hustling with whatever anyone, still I'm doing it from my desk all day long. But now it's with orchestrators and, you know,
so exciting.
Like, and I, yeah, it's so fun. I've got a few orchestrators, and just like learning how to kind of like write for an orchestra is a whole thing that I never would have ever would have. But then I suppose I've been doing it the whole time, but not really, kind of. I'd listen to sometimes of my demos that I wrote in the very beginning, and I'm like, that's so good. And it's got like orchestration in it, but I didn't know then what I know now. Kind of, I don't know.
Are you learning that stuff on the?
Go,
sorry, I was just going to say, are you learning that stuff on the fly? Are you taking classes? Like, how do you just come into that and start learning?
It's just like lightning bolts. There's so much to listen to, and I get so excited by all of it that like it's just like, for example. But I still just love rap music so much. I got completely sidetracked by Tyler the Creator's record. I don't know if any of you have heard it.
It just came out.
Oh, good. Yeah, it just came out, and I just dropped everything. I was like, oh my god, I'm scoring my first movie. Is that as cool as Tyler the Creator? I'm such an idiot. And then I just drop everything and go, all I want to do is like break down how Tyler made his rap record. I know all
the
words.
But the brilliant thing is, you will bring that sensibility to film scoring too.
That's exactly
which is
it.
Very valuable and very in demand, which is someone who doesn't just understand, didn't just go to the Royal Edinburgh Academy, with all due respect to some of my great friends who went there, but
yeah.
Feel rap or rock or electronica, but to have someone that understands both.
Yeah.
Very
well. Well, I always said that, like, you know, coming, like, listening to hip hop, there's something really important about, and this is what the same thing that I applied to Florence the Machine in the beginning, and I still do it. It's like, if it's on a loop, if you want to hear it on a loop again and again and again, it gets you in that loop. Then like, then you've got it. You've got the magic there. So like, whatever that might be. And so, you know, obviously composing takes you here and there, and emotions and feelings, and of which I can relate to all of them. So like, but, I think that like, it's interesting when you listen to Tyler's record, and then you listen to like, and then that took me on a Wu-Tang journey, and I was listening to, now I'm listening to all the bells behind all the, you know, the words and the drum loops, but then you're hearing the melodies, the drums, the guitar things that are just one note. If you put that over the top of something, you know, it takes a whole nother.
That's so great.
Sheen over the top of it. Yeah, it's
what
fun.
What are you learning?
Time.
or what are you, what is film scoring allowing you to do that you weren't able to do in your artist
career? Yeah, you know, like, I think that it's the regimen of television and, like, the being a part of a pack of wolves that are all, like, hunting, like, getting to the same place, it has been so, it's been such a useful lesson. There's no time to think, oh, is this good? Like, oh, is anyone going to listen to it? Like, I don't know. Like, there's no time for that. You just have to lean in, do your best, then talk about it once a week with everyone, which is slightly nerve-wracking. And then you get your notes, and then you either smash it or do it again and again until you do get it, or, like, or just get the you know, it's just, it's really nice to be a part of something where there's a an end date and, like, a deadline, and, like, I think that's been extremely helpful for me, my momentum. Just, like, some days I've been in this pandemic, I've been at my desk at 7 o'clock in the morning and there till 2 o'clock in the morning, just because of the demand for, like, me going, like, yes to everything. Scoring two TV shows back to back with everyone, like, needing it, where is it. So I think that that all of those things have been so, that's been so useful to me. And, like, I've been making a record for a minute now, and it is a machine record, and, like, I gotta make sure I don't drop the ball on it, because it's just so easy to get into other people's, like, worlds and go, like, I'm scoring this and it's the best thing ever. So I guess, like, I still need to kind of, like, there I am applying that discipline with my own record, but it's funny how, like, I don't have the same, I have great support for it, but, like, I just wish people would be a bit more school teacher-y with me and give me a deadline, because for me, I'm like, I want to fucking get out this year. And then the label will come on board and be like, well, that's a great idea, but we think we're realistically next. I'm like, no, don't slow me down. We're going. I feel like.
So you like the deadline.
Yeah.
Love the deadline.
Deadlines are great. It's so wonderful to have a gun at your head, literally, to say you have to have it in. Can I ask a really silly question about time zones? Is it easier when there's deadlines? Do you feel it's easier to be 8 hours ahead of us in LA? And do you get up when you're at 7 a.m., everybody else is kind of 11 p.m. the night before? And
it's actually I find it great, because what happens is I'll wake up in the morning and I'll have all of my things from people. And then that can sort of help the day, you know, help dictate the day. And then equally, like, when you guys are sleeping, I can fill your inboxes with all the things that I've been doing in the day. So it's kind of like, you know, there's some gifting going on. Sometimes
spotting sessions.
Yeah, exactly. Sometimes spotting sessions, you know, on a Friday morning for you guys is my Friday night, but whatever. Well, I mean, what does anyone be doing on a Friday night anymore?
It's interesting that your first, you know, group of projects, it's not like all the same type of music. Like, let's get Izza. We know she can do this type. Like, they're completely different types of music. And did you do that on purpose? Like, did you want to get just give me the most random genres of music? Because I want to show you what I can do.
Kind of. Well, you know, I thought that has actually been the biggest problem for me in the music industry. People didn't know what to do with me. They're like, get in the box. I'm like, what box? I don't fit in the box. Like, and they're like, you have to be one sound. And I'm like, I don't know what that is. I do this and then I go over here and do that. And that's really fun. Now I want to try that out. I can't say enough what a blessing it is, to be able to score for other people, because then they go like, right, we want it to be like synth wave. And I'm like, sick. Like, get the virus TI out. Let's just make noises on that and do this. And then, you know, of course, doing Little Fires with Mark was so awesome, because we knew we were going to be able to record real strings at Capitol. So I was just like, yeah, it gets right.
Did you go to Capitol A or B and record?
Absolutely. Yeah,
right, we did.
which was, you know, it's just like such a, like, what is going on still at that moment that I don't think I really, I took it in, but it's just like, you know, everyone else knew what we were doing and loved it. And I was just like, this is amazing. So, you know, going in like to this, like that was such a huge blessing. But then of course, then you go like, oh, well, there's no budget for strings. So we're going to have to find a way around string sounds. So like Paddock, they kind of, you know, it's all about the storytelling and the filmmakers, right? So like you kind of, it's just very collaborative and like understanding what they've been listening to while they've been writing scripts or like, you know, maybe, you know, and this is, you're really the last person. Actually, I'm finding now that I'm moving into the film world, you're not the last person, but definitely with TV, everything else has been thought out till it gets to you. And then there you are, like, so they already, you know, so with Panic, they knew what they wanted to a certain extent. And Physical, you know, is set in the early 80s. So, but, you know, we were tailing off the 70s as well. So, and she progresses, the character Sheila progresses as the time goes on. So like that, it was really fun to go on that journey musically. So.
Can you explain why you said in the film world, you're not the last person, just so. In TV, there's always this deadline that's going to go on the air. But in film, often, you know, the composer's the last writer on the film. So,
well, I guess that, like, I suppose that I'm doing things remotely. But actually, like, people are hungry for music as they're working on things at this moment. And that, you know, I had a meeting today and the guys were like, it'd be really helpful. Like the music that we're listening to is helping the way that we're shaping the story.
That's
so
great.
Can you get, and I'm like, just send me what you're listening to and like, let's get into it.
Let's get it on.
Yeah, exactly.
What film so is fun. This that you're talking about?
Well, actually, I'm scoring a
not
movie.
Not at liberty to share right now.
One
the
I'm not.
Name of the motion picture.
One I'm not, but one okay. is a movie called Cool Jane, which is directed by Phyllis Nash. Sigourney Weaver is in it and Elizabeth Banks. And it's going to be it's beautiful. It's been beautifully made and it's a serious subject. And
are you scoring solo?
It's 1968, Chicago. So we've been listening. I don't know if I'm allowed to give too much of it away, actually. So
okay.
I'll shut myself up before
that's,
then.
That's good enough.
But yes,
are you scoring
yes,
it
I am.
By yourself? Yes.
Yes, sir.
And just will it be me. Electronic and acoustic and orchestral, or you haven't decided?
No, I don't think they'll be electronic. So it'll be acoustic. And
fabulous.
I'm going to try and, yeah.
Can't wait.
Yeah.
So you've now scored with Mark Isham. You've scored with as a collaboration. You've scored with Brian H. Kim. Which is another collaboration. And then you've scored solo. So I'm curious what your take is on working with a partner and working solo. What do you prefer? And how does one benefit and one, you know, with the other?
It's obviously really nice to have the cushion of someone else to kind of lean on, especially in those first moments of not knowing what I'm doing. And I will always work with those people for sure. But I feel like, and sometimes, like, you know, these are huge budgeted things that require, you know, a lot of attention. So actually with the TV stuff, it's quite a, kind of imperative, I suppose, here and there. Like even you'll see Hans Zimmer will score with someone else, like quite often. But I'm very happy to be doing things by myself.
Good. That was one of my final questions before we let you go into your incredibly busy day is have you assembled a team around you that's kind of a music editor and a specific engineer and a specific orchestrator? A lot of film composers get so much done because they just have a, you know, they rock a crew.
Your squad.
I literally have all those things you just mentioned and then some. Oh,
that's great.
So, yeah, I mean, you know, like, and it's, and the exploration of like, you know, still, I will always be, what is that? You, how do you play that? Come over here and record it for me. And like, you know, at the beginning of projects as well, it's fun to see what new adventures I can go on, which rabbit holes I can go down with each thing.
And like, have you worked with Isabel Griffiths? Do you know her? I see your name. She is the number one orchestra contractor.
Yes.
In London.
Yes, I think we have worked together, but not. I feel like I've been talking to her.
Yes, and I just thought she's so lovely and so supportive and great at this moment for you that Isabel.
Yes.
Isabel knows everybody and every sound and every way to get it. And it just, it's another plug. This is actually sort of about you, but also about a lot of other
people. That's good. More is more.
I just thought Isabel's the greatest, and she's there. And if you need a date in an hour at Abbey Road or Air, she just says,
that's the one. Yes, 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 yes. Amazing. And thank you for putting her at the top of my imagination. I've got a big
very, very good.
Her name. Her and Cezanne.
Oh, well, Cezanne, you know.
I mean, what a crew. What crew I'm assembling.
At the end of the
I know, I'm very excited because I love painting more than I love anything else. I love painters. I find it really fascinating understanding why people do what they do.
At the end of the 19th century, Cezanne painted a few apples on a table and no one had ever seen it that flat. And Picasso and Braque saw the way that Cezanne was painting things without perspective, why do that? Photographs were suddenly taking away the need to be realistic. And the Impressionism started to evolve into these very flat paintings, which then became Cubism by the time Picasso and Braque did it. But Cezanne is the genius who put forward.
Robert Kraft, thank you so much for that. That is
we just took a turn here.
Yeah, no, that's for that sort of stuff. I look at paintings all the time. Yes.
You have not far from you at Tate Britain some of the greatest, most amazing, most inspiring work.
Yes, the Rothkos that were supposed to be in the Seagram's restaurant have always been in the Tate Modern, as far as I've known, have just moved to where they were supposed to have always been, which is the Tate Britain. And I went to see them in.
And to tie this completely together in a way that our listeners will either say, what the fuck is he talking about? Or
That's good. Get the Google out.
The Rothkos are the complete evolution of flattening a painting out so that it goes from apples to pure emotion and color.
Yes! Oh, so, that makes me so happy.
So 100 years later, Cezanne would look at Rothko and say, I totally feel you, man.
Yo. Yes. And you know what? All of that feeds in to, you know, how I create sound. So thank you.
Well, I feel you on that 100% because for me, painting and music are just I always hung out with painters as a musician because painters and visual artists, it felt like they weren't worried about getting on the charts. They were worried about getting done what you described at the very beginning of this call, which is that Ligeti quote. I just need to do the work.
Oh my god, that whole thing. Ligeti's music is like some other level.
Yes, it really is.
MGM in 2001, A Space Odyssey. I liked the film. It used my music. I accept artistically. In the 1970s, I saw a book of the making of 2001 and read that Ligeti had successfully sued MGM for taking his music. But it's not so. I never sued them. MGM wrote me such nice letters. They said Ligeti should be happy. He is now famous in America.
Huh.
And I went to see it the other day. I went to see it in 2001 at the cinema. I go to the cinema all the time to watch old movies. And I went to see 2001. And honestly, the marriage of, I mean, talk about score. The way that Kubrick used those laughable pieces of music whilst a black oblong is just floating in space that's been handcraftedly painted by people. For, I mean, talk about making art. Like, that's all painting. So funny.
Do you know that you're listening to The Temp?
No.
He temped with all those. He
and then decided that no one was going to, and no one was going to be able to beat it.
He hired Alex North, the great composer, to score the movie.
Yeah.
And when Alex North went to the premiere, they didn't even tell him. Alex North got to the premiere of the film and didn't hear a note of his music.
Shaking hands, I don't blame him,
everybody. To be honest.
He heard the temp, but it works, doesn't it?
I mean, come on. Yeah. Amazing. Amazing.
How about when Strauss goes major when you first see the sun? Ba-da!
I literally was like looking around in the cinema just laughing like anyone else. This is so like, it's so incredible and ridiculous. Just like this man, Stanley Kubrick, with all of these film investors' money, and they're all wandering around going like, standing around behind him going like, when's he going to let us see the movie? And he's just like, no, it's not right. It's not right. You know, the sets that he was building whenever it was in the 60s or whatever. And like, you know, keeping this thing like secret, this ridiculous thing that it's just so funny.
I realize what I wish for you and for every composer is the opportunity ahead to work with a director, of which they are few and far between, with all love for directors that really understand music, of which I've had the great opportunity to be next to that handful, and also embarrassedly the hundreds who say, what is that? And you say, well, that's the snare drum. You know, we have a two and four. We have can we change the tempo but keep the rhythm the same? And do we need snare drums? I've never really felt that they, but then you get next to Ang Lee or Ridley Scott and they say, I'll tell you what works and what doesn't, and you learn from them. And Kubrick, can you imagine Clockwork Orange, all those pictures, how he used
the
music?
Shining.
Shining.
Oh. The Shining. Another one that I saw.
You.
Thank you. I was going to keep going.
just a great director, because they sometimes see things in pictures that are
great. Coppola. Coppola with The Godfather. Coppola with Apocalypse Now. I saw in the cinema.
Ridiculous.
I mean, and you know what's really interesting? This is a fun story. Because I started off sampling everything from vinyl. You know, we didn't have Tidal and Spotify in 2005 or whatever, or Instagram or any of that nonsense. So nothing was fed to you. You have to find it. And I had a vinyl, the Apocalypse Now soundtrack, which isn't just the music, but it's also the dialogue. So I was sampling Marlon Brando at the end. I was sampling Dennis Hopper, "You got the cigarettes, and that's what I've been waiting for." I didn't even know that I was sampling Martin Sheen. And I went to see it only recently, and you still can't get the music separated from the dialogue, not anywhere I found. It just doesn't exist online.
You have to track down Walter Murch, who was the music editor.
Thank you.
Murch, who's still here, who thought that it would be cool to start the movie with...
Dude, what an epic.
You know the sound? That helicopter,
yeah, of course. Yeah, the Apache
coming across the screen. Walter Murch was the great sound designer who Coppola put on it, and you know, so you have that scene under the bridge where you're hearing like Hendrix in the background and explosions,
and everything's pink smoke. It's all palm trees and pink smoke, and the beginning is it's bookended, and this is what I really love about films and learning the art of scoring. Is that it's bookended by The Doors, the end. And you know, it comes in with The Doors and it ends with The Doors. And, you know, I mean, talk about rock and roll. Talk about rock and roll. So yeah. I think I'm in the right place.
You are.
I'm definitely
you are
rock in the right
and
roll. Place.
You are, and yeah. you're bringing everything that you know.
Mm-hmm.
This is why.
And I guess I'm still learning as well. I'm just like, I was listening to Carl Off yesterday.
Oh, you're going deep.
So deep. It's going to keep going.
That's why I think film scoring is the, you know, I'm needless to say, I have a distinct bias here, but when people say, oh, it sounds like movie music, I always want to say, what the fuck are you talking about? It sounds like movie music. Movie music can be The Doors or yeah. it can be Ligeti, full stop.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
that's movie music.
Yeah.
And everything Literally. In between. Or it can be The Machine. That's what they're going to be saying, you know.
I'm Which, just
by
so
the way,
excited.
Is like the most badass nickname. My nickname was Little Holmes. I was a younger brother. You're the machine. I would trade that in a heartbeat. How did you get that good. Nickname?
It's pretty good. From my MPC. It was my MPC, you know, it was like my little hip-hop beat-making machine. Florence was the robot. I told her what to do, and then I had the machine.
You and Dre.
Me and Dre. And RZA.
And RZA. And Method. Yeah. And Old Dirty right. Bastard. Have you seen the Wu-Tang documentary?
I have not. No, I should watch it.
So cool.
Is it? Okay.
Oh,
that's
it's so cool.
One on the list.
So interesting. Staten Island. Have we gone off topic enough, Kenny and Carol?
I was going to say, if our audience is still with us, they're pretty cool.
It's actually we're getting better and better, to be honest.
Yeah, I know. This is...
We sweated the small stuff, and now we're getting real.
We got to do another round in person once everything
Please.
Calms down.
I would absolutely love to.
When you're staying at the Beverly Hills Hotel, we'll come by with it.
I got more stories, but we'll save
yes,
them.
Hotel.
Thank you so much for having me.
I do want to ask you really quick. I saw you in concert at a festival once, and it was massive audience. I'm just wondering, what's the biggest audience you've played in front of?
I really don't know the answer to that.
Rock and Rio?
Hundreds of thousands of people.
Yeah.
We had
Is
like
there any way to describe that feeling for our listeners who and for us? I mean, what is it like to step on a stage with that many people knowing what you've written?
Oh, I'm just so glad that I've had that success. I'm so glad that I've had those moments because I remember at the beginning of this whole journey being in my little studio with my sounds and like, you know, grabbing people, what's that, you know, being shown Cubase and all the rest of it. But I just never really, I just knew there was a whole world out there and I wasn't ever sure how I was gonna see it. And like, you know, and then I met Florence and I was like, this girl's gonna show me the whole world. And then she did, and we really did. You know, it's just the most amazing thing, having people singing words back to you of songs that you've banged the walls to make the drums and screamed. And like, you know, oh, I've only got one thing to make the drum sound, and it's a tambourine. Will that do? So, you know, it's almost giving me, it's given me enough, like, juice almost to be able to... now just sit here and be completely happy in my own company back in that tiny little room.
God, that's because great.
The exploration of like, you know, the understanding now of cinema and the way that I'm getting to kind of, you know, now that I'm making pictures with people, like even albeit TV for now and then moving into the film world now, because I keep saying, I want to do films. And like, I just think that it's just all one great big like kind of thing. That it's yeah. The shows have been, I mean, so amazing. I think that would be a really interesting film, like the idea of fandom. But that's another story for another podcast.
Uh oh.
We'll talk about that.
News break.
Score it. You can score it. It'll be perfect.
Eventually.
Next career will be. Finally, directing
will be,
it'll be
eventually.
All the way around.
You
Kenny?
Can go John Carpenter style and score directing.
He was the whole reason that I was that. Yeah, that's why I made horror films at art school. And oh, I was so like, the leitmotif came from John Carpenter because he had the three notes. And those were the three notes that you would like.
We're going to get this episode.
Just keep it simple.
Izza, thank you so much for taking
the
time.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're so pumped for you, and your energy is infectious, and I'm sure everyone loves working with you because this has just been a lot of fun.
Thank you so much. I hope everyone watches movies in a slightly different way now. It's all about the music or the lack of.
Do we want to get Izza to say you're listening to?
Well, first we're gonna take a break. Coming up after the break, we have Oscar-winning composer Elliot Goldenthal right here on Score the Podcast. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Hey, it's Matt Schrader here. If you like Score the Podcast, you're going to want to check out More Score, our new Patreon show for Score superfans. What's Patreon? Well, it's a website and an app that lets fans crowdfund the type of extra content you want. And now More Score has it all on video. You can listen or watch right on the Patreon app. More Score already has the life stories of people you know, like Kenny and Robert from Score the Podcast, as well as bonus features, hangouts, and yes, original interviews, like Carlos Rafael Rivera from The Queen's Gambit on Netflix. Did you know he had to throw out his score and start fresh? More Score gives you insight into the film score world, and it's a beautiful addition to those of you who just can't wait for another episode of Score the Podcast. Best of all, More Score is year-round. No more off-season. Go to patreon.com/morescore or download the Patreon app and search More Score.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hi, this is Nicholas Bertel. You're listening to Score the Podcast. And now let's get back to the show.
Welcome back to Score the Podcast, presented by Spitfire Audio. I'm really excited about our guest today. He's an Oscar-winning composer of films like Frida, Batman Forever, Batman and Robin, Alien 3, Interview with the Vampire, A Time to Kill, Heat. There's so many. We could go down the list forever. Elliot Goldenthal, thank you so much for coming on the show today, sir. Maestro, how are you?
Excellent. Thank you.
Elliot, I have an important question for you just to kick it off. Where are you?
I'm in the basement below sea level in Martha's Vineyard. I've been here since last August.
Wow. And what, just for those of us who...
I haven't been off the island,
who care about this. First of all, that's amazing. No island fever yet. Can you tell me, as someone once said to me, you've rented every house on Martha's Vineyard, Robert. What neighborhood are you in? Just so we know.
And our audience is going to really love this question.
Yes.
I'm in Squibnocket.
Squibnocket, how beautiful. That's there's some beaches there that we used to, black sand and Blackstone Beach and Stonewall Beach was one.
Stonewall
Beach. That's great to know. And what a great place. I wonder, is it inspiring musically?
Well, where I am is on a bluff. So if I look out, I see the Atlantic Ocean. If I look behind, it's a forest and scrub oaks and lots of ticks, I suppose. Yeah. So, but it is inspiring because it's exposed also to the heavens. So I see the sun and moon and positions relatively to the season. I see the planets. I can pick out like four or five of them. It's majestic to see especially the sunrise. When I walk away from the sun, everything is sort of like indigo colored, and it gets lighter and lighter. And when I turn around, you have these amazing reds and fiery refraction of the atmosphere. It's just amazing. You know, growing up in Brooklyn, New York, and Manhattan, you know, all those obscured by buildings, you know, I kind of see police cars reflected off other people's windows. That's my astronomical reference.
Is there a Squibnocket Oratorio in our future?
That sounds good. It's good.
Just fun
although
to say.
I did write a symphonic commission for the Pacific Symphony Orchestra called October Light, which was premiered last December, and that was inspired by, you know, just my walks and being isolated, you know, from the spirit of time.
Are you a pretty the way you described this neighborhood and walking outside, some people would say it's pretty scenic, it's nice. You really painted a picture there. Are you a very visual guy, especially when it comes to writing music? Like, do you see the colors? Do you like, does that play a role in how you write your music, what you, the pictures, the colors, things like that?
No, I know the composer Scriabin once had a theory of colors and how it relates to the chromatic scale and etc. He once wrote a piece called Poem of Colors, a Symphony of Colors. But no, but I'm very, very, my work habits are, I start at around midnight. And then I work until 6-7 o'clock in the morning. So I take breaks like every 3 hours or so, or 2 hours, and I take walks. So I'm very sensitive to the way the heavens look, and the subtle changes of color and planetary rotation.
It's just, you know, amazing. First of all, your circadian rhythms are really interesting, not unheard of, particularly for musicians. I know someone else that just won't. Yeah, I don't know why, but that's. I
mean, Hans is like that.
And Quincy.
Oh, Quincy. I know Quincy well. Yeah, we talked about that. I think when you're a social person and I like enjoy people very much, at one point you have to it's like a drug, you have to get away from people and crawl into your own space. And I was that way my whole life, where it I disciplined myself into you know, going in my own corner, so to speak, and compose after my friends are asleep. You know, other than my friends in New Zealand and Australia.
Right, they're wide awake. Are you light sleeper? Do you crawl into bed at dawn and sleep 8 solid hours?
No. I wish. I'm averaging these days about 5.5-6 hours. Mm. 5.5. That sounds about right. But of course, I adjust professionally. If I have to show up in the morning at 9 o'clock at rehearsal, I have to do that.
Yeah, I bet. You know, or call those turkeys in L.A. who want to have a you know, meeting. And
well, Michael Mann used to have those meetings at 7 o'clock in the morning. But you know, Batman Forever was a tough schedule because it was a reduced time period I was composing, and it was like nearly 14 minutes of scoring every day.
Impossible.
And you know, so after the scoring session was started at 10, you know, before that I had to work with the conductor, brief them, Jonathan Sheffer in this case. And then And then you have the meeting with the director, in that case was Joel Schumacher, I miss him. And yeah. then you have to meet with the brain trust of Warner Brothers at that time, and then have dinner, and then go home and compose for the next day. And the copies show up at 5 o'clock in the morning. So you're on that,
it's busy.
schedule for nearly a month and a half.
Was that the first time? This is a double question. I mean, I've had an Elliott Goldenthal Festival this week. I literally have been just enjoying an incredible variety of music that pours out of you. Truly hard to pin down. This is the Elliott Goldenthal sound, which is such an asset. That may be a separate topic, but it's really interesting to see the variety. Was that Batman picture the first time you worked with Joel? Because he brought you in, I think. Is that the one that came in second?
Yes. No, I didn't hear the second part of the question.
I just wondered, did he bring you in? He brought you in to replace someone, I believe. That's why you...
No. I replaced someone in Interview with the Vampire.
That's the one. Sorry.
And Neil Jordan called me up and he said, you have 3 weeks to do the score. Are you up to it? I said, full orchestra? He said, yeah, full orchestra.
Wow.
So I enjoyed that because in the same way, it's a luxury of time. For example, you know, we did Alien 3 with David Fincher was involved, and he gave me I had a year to compose, in that period there was the studio and him were not totally agreement of every scene, so it was a lot of changes, and various directors enjoy making a lot of changes, but when you have a project like Interview with the Vampire with Neil Jordan, he said, we have 3 weeks. There's no time for changes. So in a way, it was a luxury because it was just go and do it and react to the scenes. And
you did a couple amazing pictures with Neil, too. Michael Collins, is that Neil?
I did five, yeah. Two of them was Oscar nominations. Very, very, very pleased with that whole collaboration with Neil. He's great.
In a situation like that with Interview with the Vampire, you have 3 weeks. I imagine that your process changes in some way because it's so sped up. But is it the same approach when you sit down and you know that you have 3 weeks versus a year? Like, how do you speed that type of workflow up that much? That's such a crazy difference amount of time.
You know, people who get into car accidents have eerie feeling that everything is slowed down. The events that leads up to the impact is slowed down. In that way, I breathed exhaled with the actors. On screen, I was part of the action, so to speak, the drama, where I wasn't interrupted or worry about additional edits, additional cuts, I was able to invest my full attention on the dramatic reactions to the scenes, you know, a former life before movies and even now I'm involved with theater in the beginning my 4 or 5 theater pieces were improvs to what is happening on stage. So I'm very, very I'm very attuned to that a physical reaction I had have to external acting or external movement. So I'm comfortable with that.
I like that. I like
it. That's such a cool analogy. I love how you spell that out. We do want to get into some of your film.
The car accident.
It's an interesting. It's an interesting way to look at it.
It teaches me a lot about the nature of time. Just when you say that, and how somehow
that's an interesting subject. Time, because let me roll the take back for a second,
please.
Because I forgot to say that. My favorite Neil Jordan project of the six I did, or five or six, was a little movie called The Butcher Boy. Mm. If you have a chance to look at that, it lends itself well to television. It's not a big cinematic thing. It's a very heartfelt little Irish project, and I really, really enjoyed my collaboration with Neil on that. And sorry, you were saying.
That's, first of all, I saw it and among your credits and thought it's one I've always heard about as being strong.
Have to check it out.
We'll definitely check it out. Oh, I was just saying that it's interesting, the car analogy, because you're saying that often when the pressure is on, instead of things accelerating for you and becoming frenetic, as much as that was, I'm sure, the external, you said there was a feeling of just slowing down to get things done. And I wonder how that impacts us in all things. I mean, sometimes having a gun at our head actually produces great work and great results.
Well, that happens to me quite often. When I'm in front of the, at the recording session, you have, 80, 100 musicians sometimes, and director, and so at that point everything gets extremely slow, where I'm listening to this second bassoon or this and that. I'm very, very, very conscious of because all that stuff lives after you, It's funny with time, and it's also funny with time composing to film, because sometimes it's counterintuitive to think of that a slow piece of music during fast action. Sometimes that speeds the perception of time, as opposed to composing frenetic fast music to a frenetic action scene.
Anticipated one of my questions. It's so funny you said that. I've had, in my Elliot Goldenthal Festival, I not only rewatched Frida and was reminded of so much of that.
That's beautiful, because it was so melodic. It was like a vacation to enjoy writing melodies,
So it's lush. You can almost dive into the score and just kind of swim in it. It's so much music and beautiful music. And I have a couple questions about it and the beautiful film. But when I listen to Heat again, one of my favorite scores and favorite movies, one of the things that amazed me, which I didn't remember, is what you just said. It's footballs. It's long passages. And to just listen to it without seeing the picture, because I didn't screen the picture, I just listened to the score, I thought, this music brings up the same emotion I had watching it, which is kind of anxiety and some confusion, and there's sadness in there a little bit, and there's a lot that's in the movie. But also, which scene is this where it's just these long passages? Isn't Tom Skidmore and here's Val Kilmer racing around? I couldn't figure out why they were long legato passages in Heat or where they were. I thought the score was frenetic, and it wasn't.
Well, it has a frenetic moments. If the tune on the album anyway is called The Heist.
Yeah.
And then it starts just as you say, long sustained notes, and that was establishing Los Angeles with Michael Mann-esque, lights of Los Angeles, and then when it starts the actual machinations of the heist, it's almost a heartbeat subwoofer thing that gets going, and a string quartet is playing. Started out being nervous, and it gets to frenetic. But to your point, Michael Mann was always very, very helpful and instructive, in pointing me out of these really car chase things and stuff, and just play something sustained over it, and let's see the reaction. And all of a sudden, it starts to work, is many scenes that supports what you exactly is saying. And when we did also Public Enemies, Johnny Depp and blah, 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 and he had the same reaction. He's very, very, very keen on that approach. I think he was even keen on that approach in Miami Vice, with a television approach as a producer.
It's the director. Confidence also of a filmmaker who says, you know, it's the less experienced filmmakers that think, I gotta amp this up, I might not have done it enough, but I'm just guessing, but Michael Mann knows the rhythm of the picture and the solidity of what he shot doesn't need the composer to gas it up. It works. I mean, I thought the music was faster than it was, just because I...
Well, listen to it again. You'd be surprised. There are a lot of fast scenes and a lot of exactly how you describe scenes. But and Michael Mann doesn't lack for confidence, and he also had a lot of power, and that helps, because he doesn't have to go back to a parliamentarian kind of situation when he finishes something. It's done.
A luxury.
Yes.
Elliot, we like to go back a little bit and talk about how you became what you are as a composer, as a musician. So you grew up in New York?
I grew up in Brooklyn, New York.
Brooklyn. And your parents weren't musicians, right?
My father was a house painter, and my mother was a seamstress.
So were you?
But they loved music. Obviously not. It was always music playing, and very good music,
But so they listened to a lot of music, but you weren't exposed to like musicians as a kid.
What do you mean, a kid? When does a kid start? When does a kid stop?
That's a great
age-wise, I know philosophically it can last forever, but you're referring to what?
I guess I just mean in your childhood, growing up in the house, like in grade school, were you playing musical instruments at this time? Were you a kid playing out in the street, scuffing your knees? What was your free time like as a kid?
Well, I played piano because there was a piano in the house, a little spinet. And when I was 12 years old, I got a trumpet as a gift for my father. He got it in a pawn shop. So that really, really helped me, because I was playing in community bands and community orchestras and things like that. So, you sit there where everyone else is rehearsing. And you're listening to stuff, and you take it all in. At the same time, I grew up in the world of jazz and rock and roll and stuff. I had my own band, a blues band, and I was lucky enough at 14 years old to attend the Woodstock Festival, with my wow. older brother. And I was really lucky to have my mother had three boys, 9 years apart. Each brother brought with them their own records, their own music. So I was educated in a 18-year span above me.
So you were the youngest.
I inherited all those records. So, and one was a tremendous jazz fan. And he used to, I wouldn't say drag, but he let me come along to hear Miles Davis and Mingus and Coltrane and Dizzy Gillespie and Rose playing on the other side of the subway. And, I was lucky to be in New York at the time and to have those conditions. But
were you a film fan as well, though? Like in terms of film composing, was that anything you were paying attention to, or was it mostly like the artists?
Later on in my childhood, being when I was about 15, 16, there used to be three art house studios in New York. And it was amazing. They used to have Fellini festivals and John Ford festivals and Kurosawa festivals. And it used to go on, a week or 2 weeks at a time. Charlie Chaplin festivals, movies from Russia and blah, blah, blah. I listened to these movies and Hitchcock festivals, and you listen to it and says, my God, what amazing composers, varied and amazing. Bernard Herrmann and Nino Rota and all these movies. And you see that as a kid, you said, I can't wait to be part of that cinema thing. It's really exciting.
What I like about what you said is you've just described very innocuously this incredible combination of, well, there's Woodstock, so you're hearing Jimmy and The Who, and you're exposed to all that, of course. There's Coltrane and Miles and Mingus, so you're hearing that. And then there's film music you mentioned, and then there's this classical thing, and it actually starts to explain the Elliot Goldenthal stew. Yeah. Which is this kind of completely contemporary mix of all that. And I've always been interested in that, Elliot, how you found a way to express the film with its own language that combined these elements.
Yeah, it for me, it was very, it's just autobiographical in a sense that
it's beautiful.
That's what I heard, as well as, Mozart as a kid, not comparing myself, but as a musician, he was, as a kid, very gifted, and he was taken around various European cities, so he was exposed to Italianate stuff, German stuff, Austrian stuff, Spanish stuff. When I opened my window, or even closed my window in Brooklyn, I hear everything, a guy playing Wagner, someone playing, salsa whatever, Aretha Franklin, all day,
Yeah. Was there a moment where, I've never known this, and I certainly have read a lot of the interviews, but I don't know what your first film was and who said, hey, would you like to try this?
Well, it was two movies. First of all, let me back up before the first movie. I had a friend who was attending first year of NYO film school, and he invited me to lectures by Haga Manoogian, and various teachers at NYU Film Music School. So what I did, I put up a little sign on a, you know, on the bulletin board, said, I'll compose anything for any student film as long as you can pay the musicians. I'll do it free, you know. So I did, you know, scores of many film scores for students, and I had a good buddy, Louis Bertini, who became later became a very, very good editor, sound editor, but he had friends of friends who was introduced me to this German producer, Christoph Gierke, who was working with a German director named Uli Nomo, who was not very good at these movies. He says, Elliot, can you do two movies or three movies for me? For $2,000, that includes your fee, musicians, copying, everything. So I did it. Two movies, one with Andy Warhol and Jack Palance, the other one called Cocaine Cowboys. Wow. The other one called Blank Generation with all the great Richard Hell and the Voidoids. And Andy Warhol, et cetera, et cetera. So he was in an interesting crowd, but the movies weren't that good. But still, I had the responsibility of doing everything, composing, copying, conducting, and mixing. And then at the end, I didn't get paid because he says, oh, we're going to defer the money. So it was
when you went into class and wrote that on the board, what was the end goal of that though? At that point, were you like, I want to be a full on film composer? Were you just trying to get reps doing different type of work?
No, I didn't think of film composing as a separate category. I thought it was a really cool thing. You know, it's like, you know, if you're athletically inclined, you played baseball and basketball and football, and you didn't say, I want to be, you know, you enjoy the participation of, in various things that you can, as a human, express yourself or being part of.
It's interesting that Cocaine Cowboy and Blank Generation, though they might not have been good, they both have a certain legendary quality of being, you know, art
legendary
films.
Bad. Yeah.
Yeah. Legendary bad, but sort of they have captured moments. It's funny. Cocaine Cowboy comes up in Midnight Cowboy and Warhol, and he was jealous. There's a scene in Midnight Cowboy that's a big party scene, and Warhol felt that, you know, it was ripping him off and vice versa. But did it give you the reputation of being, somehow allied with the avant-garde? In other words, suddenly you end up doing these huge Hollywood movies. But I imagine somebody thought, oh, he's
no, those early movies, like it was 1979, 1980, and that was a separate lifetime almost. That was a... The crowd I was kind of stumbling around with was downtown New York, avant-garde, quote-unquote, artists and musicians. And I wasn't part of any clique or anything, but I was kind of in on a first-name basis, kind of on the periphery. But then... it took like 10 years before I did Drugstore Cowboy and Pet Sematary in the same year. I forgot which one was first, Gus Van Sant and Mary Lambert. Yeah. But that came about an entirely different way. That came about through theater. I was doing theater with my wife, Julie Taymor, at the time, and still are. But we did a piece called Juan Darien, which is entirely in Latin and Spanish. And it was at the time, it was at a little church in West 46th Street in Manhattan. And it got a lot of attention. And it won the Obie Award that existed, Villa's Voice thing. And so it had a lot of attention of directors and film directors going to the production. Hmm. And I was was introduced to my work in the theater, and they became curious. And my classical teacher, John Crigliano, who I studied with for 7 years, and I parenthetically knew since 1961 when I was a little boy. He came from the same neighborhood in Brooklyn, and he said, "You have to meet this guy, Sam Schwartz, this agent." And he, Theater Works, John Crigliano, and everything kind of was a stew that led up to Jokes to a Cowboy. It was such an interesting story because Gus Van Sant asked Sam to send me him my music from the stage piece Juan Darien. Mm-hmm. He listened to it. He lost the tape. Huh. and his editor found a tape unlabeled. It was my tape, and he temp the whole movie with my score to Juan Darien. It was horrible. The temp was horrible. But he was interested in working with me, and I thought the movie was absolutely great.
Great movie.
That's crazy.
That is amazing.
This hour is going by so fast. We're going to take a quick break, okay. And when we come back, much more with Elliot. We'll be right back on Score the Podcast.
Hey guys, it's good to see you. I wanted to tell you about this thing called More Score. Have you heard about this?
I have heard about it but that's because I read everything. So I mean, there's very little I've
it gets
heard
printed
about.
Daily
and I'm on
and,
it
delivered to your front doorstep. Yeah. Yes, More Score is what it is.
It's our new Patreon show, and all of our listeners can go check it out. We're putting out episodes all the time, and you're probably wondering, what's Patreon? Have you heard of Patreon before?
Could you tell me?
Rob, I'd be delighted to tell you. Patreon is a website where our fans basically can crowdfund and tell us the type of content that they would like us to be able to go produce. So we've been going out and doing interviews with people. Obviously, we've interviewed you both directly there and a little bit about your lives and the people who you've crossed paths with, but also Carlos Rafael Rivera of The Queen's Gambit on Netflix, and the guys from Cobra Kai, which it was kind of cool. We found out that when we recorded with Chris Beck for Score a Film Music Documentary, those guys were just getting coffee. They might have offered us coffee.
I think Zach said they did, I think. And it was great coffee, which was a great sign for their futures.
Yes.
I remember that, and he actually told me his career has been completely downhill since that moment. But
that wasn't in the interview, so it doesn't count. If he said anything of the sort, then it wasn't on the record.
Okay, Zach, sorry, man.
But we're putting these episodes out all the time. More Score. How do you get to it? You can go to patreon.com/morescore or download the Patreon app and search More Score. Oh, of course, here's my alarm going off right as we're recording this.
That's because it's so exciting. You've set the alarm off.
This is like these little reads that we're doing right now for more score are, we're going to do a couple of them and our listeners can collect them all if they aren't hitting that little 15.
You should make an
button,
NFT out of them. Yeah.
I was going to say, you can make a non-fungible token out of a more score read.
Yeah, we could do that. We do have an official season four Score the Podcast NFT that's now available. We have one for each season, not for each episode, but for each season. So if anyone out there, we're getting off track. More Score is on Patreon. It's you can go to it, patreon.com/morescore. We're putting out episodes all the time and it's extra stuff. It's stuff you won't hear on Score the Podcast. Access to different people, interesting voices. And for your support, we have these perks too. So you can get a pretty cool little collector's t-shirt that we're putting out now. This coffee mug that's pretty cool. It has all the kind of our orchestra instrument look on it. It's pretty cool stuff. So you can support us there, patreon.com/morescore.
Hi, this is Howard Shore. You're listening to Score the Podcast. Now let's go back to the program.
Welcome back to Score the Podcast, presented by Spitfire Audio. We're here with Oscar-winning composer Elliot Goldenthal. Elliot, earlier you brought up Batman Forever, and obviously we just hit the 1 year mark of losing Joel Schumacher. I'm wondering how would you characterize your guys' working relationship? You worked on a few movies together, but big ones, big at the box office, and it was a big decade for you guys working together. What was your relationship like working?
Well, in the Batmans, Joel was under extreme pressure, but yet through all that pressure, he let me do my thing, and my thing meaning I wanted to compose his movie completely, not look back at the history of the other Danny's wonderful work on the other movies or think about anything else. And Joel's sensibility was very theatrical and comic book like. It was it didn't take itself very seriously in a good way, and that was Joel's philosophy. It's disposable culture. It can be great, but it's just like a comic book, you know, and it's not like Sturm und Drang, and it's not like something that you have to wring your fingers and hands and sweat. But he wanted it to be fun, heroic, zany, at times a little rebellious, and it was a big movie, so he wanted a big orchestral sound. He wanted a new Batman theme. It was a new Batman mobile. It was a new Batman. So he wanted a new Batman theme. But everyone knew that the television show and Danny's music and whatever had its own contributions.
Well, right now there's, you know, a million superhero themes every day, every week something comes out. But back then, a superhero movie came out not very often, and it was a really big deal. And I specifically remember that movie being like a crazy marketing budget. I mean, everywhere you looked, it was Batman Forever, the bright colors, it was on fast food cups, everything.
Can I persuade you to take a sandwich with you, sir?
I'll get drive-thru.
How early were you working on that film, and was that pressure for you? I mean, in our documentary, you talked about seeing the movie poster and seeing those deadlines
in front of you. That movie was
everywhere, and there was a lot going on with that money wise. Were you feeling that?
It goes back to what I said about the car accident. You know, yeah. When it gets up to that moment, it was just, you know, 1 foot in front of
head
the other.
Down.
That yep. was I, a head down. Exactly.
How early were you writing the themes on that? Did you have a head start, or did, were you looking at picture when you?
Yeah. About a good 6 months before that, he wanted to me to record along with Warner's. I think we wanted to record a good 15, 20 minute sample with a full orchestra.
Wow. Because I was listening through, especially the villain themes, and once you see Jim Carrey on screen, did he change any of the themes when you saw him on screen with Tommy Lee Jones and the colors and just the way they were on? It's so zany, and there's so many different styles of music utilized when Edward Nygma is on the screen. How much did that influence your
absolutely
themes?
Absolutely. I wanted more and more and more and more in terms of input. I react to the movie. I don't subject my music on the score screen. The screen tells me what to do. I'm a part of collaboration, and one of the next to last collaborators is me. And I wanted more and more in terms of effects. Visual effects, computers, effects. I wanted to see more. So everything influenced me. Colors, editing.
I think there's even a theremin in there at one point.
Yeah. Because, in that scene, he's showing all his gadgets, it's a kind of, it alluded to, the fantastical elements of 1950s, scientific, futuristic, gadgets. That was nice. I enjoyed the theremin. I mixed the theremin with the soprano with a lot of vibrato, so it had a weird...
I was going to say, I was listening, and I'm like, is that a theremin? No, it's a voice. No, it's a theremin. Yeah, I listened to it like five times in a row to check.
It's both. Yeah.
Oh, that's man. So cool.
Did you write and record on the West Coast? In other words, you're a pretty diehard...
I did. I recorded, yeah.
You were never tempted to move to these sunny... Hollywood Hills. You've stayed East Coast the whole time.
No, I don't know how to drive a car.
Okay, that's good.
Me and Quincy. No,
you and Quincy. That's absolutely right. I think Hans too, and I think it's probably a saving grace. But I also really understand the value of not only being in New York, but of keeping a little distance from this mania.
Well, what happens is, as I described, walking around in the country side and next to the ocean, I'm the same way in the city. From midnight to 6 in the morning, I take walks through the streets and enjoy walking through cities and it's something about Los Angeles. It's absolutely beautiful city because of all of its contrasts and nature. It's gorgeous, but it's hard to walk around. You set off alarms if you walk around, But I found that going to Los Angeles and working with the great musicians in Los Angeles, recording musicians, it's just amazing. Sight reading, just amazing. I enjoy going out there and feeling, especially in December, feeling.
Yeah, no kidding.
It's
the perfect combo, and I won't bore you with the details of my next book, which after Midnight Cowboy, which is all New York, I've started the book The Big Goodbye, which is the story of Chinatown and the great melancholy and desolation of Los Angeles that Robert Towne, the screenwriter, feels, and he mentions walking, but he mentions walking in this kind of Raymond Chandler-esque sunlight and shadow. So interesting. I wanted to ask you, just curiously enough, I don't know any other composer, I'm trying to think, who has actually scored the films directed by his wife. That is, I think, unique in the annals of film history. I don't know if it exists. I just wondered, I mean, I can't imagine if my wife came in while I was writing music and said, I don't think so. You gotta have something else. It'd just be curious. I think our audience who loves and adores your scores would love to know, how do you keep your own sense of what's right for the film when your actual partner says, this is what I need, or this is what I love you, dear, but this doesn't work? Has there ever been a secret to how that all worked out?
Well, yeah, it is a secret, but the secret is not more commonplace in the sense that we met working together in the theater. We met in 1981, and we worked solidly for 5 years in the theater before anything romantic happened, you know. We already had more of a foundation of a certain relationship dynamic that was already extremely established before anything that was a romantic dynamic. Of course, what you say. If I'm working on something and she happens to enter the room, she might, you know, not like what you're hearing, but I say, wait until the musicians show up, wait until this, wait until that. So it's the same situation, but I think she kind of knows, give Elliot a time where he can go off and do his thing. The great thing about her is she's very close with working with actors and performances. So during the editing process, she gives me the opportunity to see if the music can enhance the scene before she edits it. For example, we did two movies that I'm very proud about. One, especially proud, is Titus, Anthony Hopkins, and in that movie, Shakespeare movie, she decided not to use any temp music but my own music from various movies. That didn't work out, because the best of what I was capable of. I was lucky to find those themes in other movies. So when she temped it, I said, oh, I was already lucky once. I can't imagine doing it again, you know, going down that same road and having to pave the same road. So that was very difficult in terms of working relationship because of that temp music situation. On Frida, she said, throw that out. Now just compose from scratch, no temp music whatsoever. I'm going to show it to for producers, the studio, whatever. It was Harvey Weinstein at the time. Everything you do, just do it on the screen. And that's the way it is. And I found that she gravitated toward the first impressions that I did as a composer more than anything else.
That music is wall to wall in the film too. I mean, there's
whether Titus and Frida.
Frida. There's not only the score, which is magnificent, but their little conjuntos playing and people going by on a truck playing and people in the back of a restaurant playing. I mean, it's just
you're immersed.
Lusciously musical and wonderful and well-deserving. And you write the song at the end with Julie.
Right, Bernard Blue, Caetano Veloso, and Lila Downs.
Oh God, I love both artists too.
Yeah,
so,
and this year we did Glorious, the Glorious. So that's this year's collaboration.
I was curious about the Glorious because there's a kind of Duane Eddy guitar in there, and I thought, well, Glorious Steinem. Like a Western hero here in a sort of, you know, it starts with her coming into North Dakota or wherever that is, South Dakota, Sturgis, the bicycle rally. And that makes sense. And the boots go down on the ground, the motorcycles. But I thought I actually started to have a little bit of I have to go back and listen to Elliot's work. Is he like, there's the guitar there. There's the guitar in all throughout Frida. I started to think, is guitar your secret weapon, or was it just accidental?
It's another color we all grew up with, and the guitar is capable of doing so many, so many sonic variations. If you listen to Heat. There's a tune that I really like, a composed called Condensers. That's in Heat. And in Butcher Boy, you'll see that has a similar approach to a long, sustained, amplified guitar. Trickled in throughout the scores is various guitar approaches. Even
Public Enemies has kind of even a what's interesting is there are different flavors of guitar playing, which kind of makes your point, which is that it's always guitar has all these colors. It's either kind of a authentic rock sound or a country sound. I found it was really interesting because I think the takeaway is Elliot's orchestral. Yeah, but listen to all the rock guitar shit.
Look Why I Grew Up, right. Woodstock, et cetera, et cetera. But in terms of the Glorious, yes, I see a bus. I see a yellow line on a highway. And, expansive middle America. Gloria, as her best work as a, continued work as a political force was from the 1960s to now. That's the sweet spot of American guitar playing. And you can't think about a Greyhound bus without thinking of racial politics and protest situations in the United States and going to some sort of rock event. You get on a bus, you go, when you go on a Greyhound bus, it has to be some guy that comes on, or a woman comes on with a guitar, and it's like an Americana rarefication of highway guitar rebelliousness. And all wrapped up in one. And I wanted the guitar to be solo. What a kind of a solo guitar can do, amplified in terms of music, lyrical lines, not just fuzz or noise or just expansive lyrical long lines of guitar sonorities.
Where did you record that?
In New York and Manhattan Center.
Oh, nice.
And I did a fair amount of like 20 or 30 movies in the Manhattan Center. And out in Los Angeles, I really love Sony.
Everybody
Elliot,
does.
Is there, Is there a moment that you can share with us where you overcame a big problem and it sticks with you, something where you ran into a huge roadblock and you were able to overcome it and make things happen? Because when you finish a film, we get this beautiful piece, but we know that it's never perfect going through it. Is there something that sticks out to you over your career where you're proud of something that you overcame like that?
It always feels like everything is, you know, an obstacle you have to overcome. You know, it's always difficult. You know, you sit down to a movie, a new movie, and it's like, oh my God, this is so difficult. What am I going to do? You know, always that way.
You know? What do you do next when you hear that voice in your head say, because I don't know any artist that wouldn't say, I can't do this, they got the wrong guy. But there's always some kind of system or technique that artists have. What is yours for when you look at the picture and you think, this is so difficult? Do you just start noodling?
My
or do you take a night walk?
No, my technique is to watch the actor's eyes and see what's behind the eyes, see what the machinations. At one point, an actor snaps into the decision. It is something in an actor's eyes that tells you what's going on. If you can be a part of that, and that starts something. And also in Alien 3, for example, I didn't have that as much, but David Fincher said something to me. He said, when you walk into a room in my movie, I want you to feel immediately fucked. You know, I said, I see. I wanted to compose the rooms, the space around the actors, not so much the actors, but the environment. So you say, like, what's that? I hear something. Don't you hear that? Oh man, I just heard something. Didn't you? No, I didn't hear anything. Oh, yes. You know, it's something like that. And that was the key into that.
What a great note. I mean, it's that's dread.
And
it's the unknown.
That's right. That's right. And the other thing in that picture, I wanted to use a boy soprano. They're very, very vulnerable child. The idea of and I also wanted to use a regular old piano, and because a piano reminds you of domestic experience, life on earth, and a child connects us to all our own vulnerabilities. So I wanted that to play along with very, very, very sometimes dissonant and scary orchestral music around you.
I'm trying to think. I've listened to so much of your music over the last few weeks. Which score it felt like had almost a slightly detuned piano, kind of out of tune, and it might have been Aliens that, as much as it was domestic, it made me a little uncomfortable, and I can't remember where it was. And it might have just been a cue in Frida that was like a piano playing along, but I remember thinking, this isn't like a Steinway concert grand. This is a feeling of a little bit of a rickety, just like you said, a spinet. I wonder what brand spinet, do you know? This is a personal question.
Do I had in my house?
That you had growing up. Do you remember?
It was a weird brand. It was called
Everett?
Gulbranson. It was
okay,
it was
Gulbranson. Weird. Yep.
Yeah.
I just.
I often like to do that detuning string instruments. Piano was a string instrument.
Yeah.
And if you listen to the Beatles, for example, that came my experience with Across the Universe, I thought about this a great deal. If you listen to them, they knew how to tune their guitars quite well. If they, you know, if we wanted it to tune it with electronic tuners and tuning forks, but they didn't. They loved the beats and the conflict between the strings when it is slightly out of tune, sometimes very out of tune, and the out of tuneness, or I shouldn't say that. That's I would say the creative use of tuning in the Beatles as a band was unbelievable, and I found some of the greatest music is not really in tune to tempered tuning. So sometimes I detune a piano, or I compose the same, I record the same notes on two different pianos at the same time, playing the same notes. So there's a rub, a sonic rub.
That's fascinating.
That is amazing. It also reminds me, the first time that I played a Beatles, it probably was a cassette or an 8-track in my car, and I heard John Lennon on two sides coming out of the door speakers in a doubled vocal, and they weren't in tune. And I thought, yes. I've always listened to this, you know, mono or whatever it was, and never realized that not only did they not really mix it, but he didn't sing great with himself, and yet the rub of those two vocals next to each other is
and yet the same four guys, if they wanted to harmonize perfectly, they harmonize perfectly in tune, absolutely totally locked in. And live in the studio, they know exactly what they were doing in terms of pitch.
Yeah.
Calculated detuning.
Yeah. No. Yeah. But more like, this is music, you know?
Yeah.
You don't listen to John Coltrane and those bands and say, you know, come on, you know, push the reed in it a little bit, you know?
The remarkable thing about listening to so many of those other artists who didn't have the ability to comp vocals or tune vocals, how phenomenally in tune they were organically when they recorded. That's one of my favorite things to hear about live recording. And the Beatles at Shea Stadium, as much as they're screaming, you listen to the vocals, exactly what you just said, Elliot, they are right in tune. As are you, my friend. You are an in-tune human being. Right. Truly, truly one of the greats. We are so lucky to have Elliot.
This hour flew by. I mean, we had so much stuff to I mean, we got to do a round two sometime in the future, but we really appreciate your time, Elliot. Thanks for coming on the show.
Well, it went by fast.
It did. And Squib Knock, it's lucky to have you in the neighborhood. That's all I can say.
A quick reminder to our listeners, you can follow us on Twitter, Score the Podcast, Instagram, Score Movie, Facebook, Score a Film Music Documentary. Don't forget to subscribe to More Score, exclusive interviews, merch, all the good stuff that you won't get here on the show. And stick around after the show today. We're going to play you a clip from Spitfire Audio where you can hear some of the different sounds to elevate your music. Robert, take it away, man.
To elevate and Elliot your music. That's what we got today. I want to just thank Elliot, one of my heroes and inspirations. Elliot, it's just fascinating to talk to you, man, because you are truly a titan in our field, and I know that a lot of the Score listeners have been very eager to have you as a guest. They've requested you, so Maestro, many
thanks. See you folks. See you, Robert. Yeah. Bye.
Hey, Score listeners, we are so grateful for the support of Spitfire Audio. They collaborate with people like Hans Zimmer and the Bernard Herrmann Estate to build sample libraries that elevate your music, and you're about to hear a demo of what that sounds like.
And remember, if you like what you hear, which I guarantee you will, as an exclusive to Score listeners, Spitfire is offering 25% off your first order using the promo code SCORE2021. That's exclusive to Score the Podcast listeners.
That's pretty nice. I mean, that's just like it's a total hookup. It is a gift. Right now, we're going to play you a demo cue of one of their great packages. This is I had it written down here. I want to make sure we say the right one.
That cool strings package.
The Spitfire Symphonic Strings Professional. I like to call it the Triple S, the Spitfire Symphonic Strings Professional Package. Check out this demo cue, and if you like what you hear, you can save 25%. Check it out. Again, if you want to get a package from Spitfire Audio and it's your first time purchasing, use the promo code SCORE2021, save 25%. I think we'll be back in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, can't wait.
We have another great guest coming up.